Welcome, everyone, to another deep dive. I'm Alex Johnson, your guide, ready to unpack some of the most significant federal news of the week.
Great to be here.
And joining me today, as always, is our brilliant expert, Sam Kennedy, who's going to help us connect all the dots and make sense of some truly dense material.
It is great to be here, and I'm certainly looking forward to diving deep with you into these, well, pretty critical developments.
Today, we're embarking on a crucial deep dive into the federal news update for Friday, August 29th, 2025.
Mm-hmm.
Our mission today is to give you a thorough, comprehensive, and exhaustive report on each and every action and activity of the U.S. federal government since the beginning of August 28th, 2025.
Right.
You shared a stack of incredibly dense and important sources, and we're here to extract the most important nuggets of knowledge for you.
Yeah, there's a lot in there.
What our sources reveal is that in less than 48 hours, we've witnessed a rapid escalation of a strategic agenda aimed at fundamentally reshaping the U.S. federal government.
It's quite remarkable, the speed and scope.
Yeah, this wasn't just isolated policy adjustments. These were interconnected components of a broader, highly coordinated campaign. We'll be dissecting actions from the executive, legislative, and judicial branches, detailing their immediate impacts and forecasting their long-term strategic implications. It's a lot to cover, so let's get right to it.
Indeed. What's particularly striking about this period is how these seemingly disparate actions, you know, taken across different branches, reveal a coordinated, multi-front offensive to transform American governance.
Exactly.
We're going to explore not just the what, but crucially, the why it matters, connecting these individual pieces to the bigger picture for you, our listener.
So let's dig into this whirlwind of activity, starting with the executive branch. Our sources reveal that August 28, 2025, saw the executive branch launch a coordinated series of initiatives.
Mm-hmm.
These weren't just random acts. They appear to be a concerted effort to centralize power within the White House, curtail external influences, and impose a specific ideological framework.
Zooming out, this represents a coherent strategy,
yeah,
aimed at fundamentally altering the relationship between the executive, the federal bureaucracy, and indeed, civil society itself.
A fundamental shift.
It really is. It's a foundational shift in how the administration perceives its role and the role of other institutions.
First up, we're looking at two significant directives that seem aimed at diminishing the power of non-governmental organizations and federal employee unions.
Right.
Groups often perceived by this administration as part of an administrative state resistant to executive-led change.
And this immediately prompts the question of how the administration views traditional checks and balances within the federal system, right?
Yeah.
Seemingly targeting both external advocacy groups and internal forces within the civil service.
Okay, so let's get specific. On August 28, President Donald J. Trump signed a presidential memorandum titled Use of Appropriated Funds for Illegal Lobbying and Partisan Political Activity by Federal Grantees. This memo directs the Attorney General to investigate whether federal grant funds are being illegally used for political lobbying and to take appropriate enforcement action.
And there's a deadline, too.
Yes, the Attorney General is specifically mandated to report on this investigation within 180 days.
Now, the administration's fact sheet, it frames this initiative as a necessary step to enhance accountability and safeguard taxpayer dollars from what they describe as waste, fraud, and abuse.
Okay, standard justification.
But our sources cite specific examples highlighted by the administration. NIH funding for a project adapting an LGBTQ plus teen pregnancy prevention program for transgender boys.
Right.
And a U.S. National Science Foundation grant focused on advancing racial justice in elementary mathematics.
What stands out in this analysis is that while this memorandum is presented as an enforcement of existing law, the selection of these specific grants focusing on LGBTQ plus health and racial justice could signal a broader ideological filter at play.
It certainly raises questions.
What are the practical consequences for grant recipients like universities and nonprofits, regardless of the stated intent?
Well, this sends a very clear signal to organizations that work in, let's say, politically sensitive areas, that they will face heightened scrutiny.
Okay.
The immediate consequence will likely be a chilling effect, where organizations may self-censor, scale back advocacy, or simply avoid controversial topics altogether to preempt costly and reputation-damaging investigations.
So the investigation itself becomes the tool.
Exactly. Even without a formal finding of wrongdoing, it becomes a powerful instrument of political pressure, potentially jeopardizing future funding and their standing. It effectively transforms the grant-making process into, well, a tool for ideological conformity.
Right. Okay. Then in a well, profound move for the federal workforce, President Trump also signed an executive order titled Further Exclusions from the Federal Labor Management Relations Program.
This one's huge.
Yeah, citing the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978, this order ends collective bargaining with federal unions in a wide array of agencies newly designated as having national security missions.
And the scope here is key.
It is exceptionally broad. Our sources list affected agencies, including hydropower facilities and the Bureau of Reclamation, NASA, the National Weather Service, and the National Environmental Satellite Data and Information Service within NOAA.
So not just the typical defense or intelligence agencies.
Not at all. Also, the Office of the Commissioner of Patents at the Patent and Trademark Office, the U.S. Agency for Global Media, and the International Trade Administration within the Department of Commerce.
The official justification for this order is that procedural requirements of federal labor management relations, particularly things like midterm union bargaining, create unacceptable delays.
That's the argument.
Right. The White House argues these delays impact agencies' ability to implement policies swiftly and fulfill their critical missions, aiming for a responsive and accountable civil service to protect our national security.
So speed and responsiveness.
And to give some context, the Civil Service Reform Act of 1978 laid down many of the foundational rules for federal labor relations. So using it to justify these exclusions is a highly strategic legal maneuver.
The takeaway from this order is clear. It represents one of the most significant alterations to federal labor relations in decades, potentially ending collective bargaining rights for an estimated 1 million federal workers.
A million, yeah.
Roughly 4/5 of the unionized federal workforce. But the expansive application of national security to agencies like the National Weather Service or the Patent and Trademark Office, it seems to stretch the definition far beyond traditional interpretations. What's your take on that scope?
Absolutely. The immediate impact is the swift termination of existing collective bargaining agreements for these agencies. It's huge.
It's gone.
Pretty much. This grants agency management unilateral authority over nearly all aspects of employment, from working conditions to disciplinary procedures. This severely weakens protections for federal employees, making it much harder for them to challenge arbitrary decisions or to act as whistleblowers.
A major power shift.
Definitely. And federal employee unions like AFGE and NFFE immediately condemned it as a disgraceful and retaliatory attack, and they have already vowed legal challenges.
Yeah.
You're right. The broad interpretation of national security to include agencies not typically associated with defense certainly suggests a much wider agenda than simply protecting classified information.
And crucially, these two actions, the grants memorandum and the collective bargaining executive order, they aren't isolated events.
No, they're connected.
Our sources highlight a third, less conspicuous action that ties them together into an even more comprehensive strategy.
That's right. The Federal Labor Relations Authority, which is the independent agency responsible for resolving federal labor disputes.
The FLRA.
Yes, the FLRA also issued a final rule on August 28th. This rule announces the closure of its Chicago regional office and the elimination of its collaboration and alternative dispute resolution office. This is explicitly stated as being done to comply with an earlier efficiency order. By tangibly reducing the FLRA's capacity and resources, the administration is effectively weakening the very mechanism through which federal employee unions could challenge these new executive orders and policies.
So you take away the union's power and then you weaken the body that could hear their complaints.
Precisely. These three actions together, the grants memo, the collective bargaining EO, and the FLRA's reduced capacity, form a highly coordinated campaign to consolidate executive control and disempower dissenting voices both within and outside the federal bureaucracy.
Okay, shifting gears slightly, we examine how the administration also took steps to impose a specific cultural vision on the physical representation of the U.S. government, moving from bureaucracy to aesthetics, you could say.
Yeah, it's noteworthy how this extends beyond traditional policy areas into what could be seen as a state-sanctioned aesthetic, an attempt to define national identity through the very architecture of its federal buildings.
President Trump signed an executive order titled Making Federal Architecture Beautiful Again, which mandates classical architecture as the preferred and default style for new federal public buildings, especially within the District of Columbia.
Preferred and default, that's key phrasing.
It is. The order directs that federal buildings should uplift and beautify public spaces, ennoble our nation, and command respect. What's interesting is that the GSA administrator must notify the proponent 30 days in advance if a design deviates from this classical style.
So a direct line to the president on architectural choices.
Seems so. And it specifically identifies brutalism. that often stark, heavy concrete look in deconstructivism, with its fragmented, sometimes chaotic forms, as disfavored styles.
Right, explicitly calling those out.
And the GSA is also tasked with recruiting architects experienced in classical and traditional styles.
Now, this directive is actually a revival of a similar order from 2020.
Okay, so not entirely new.
Not entirely. The administration's rationale draws heavily on a historical narrative, arguing that founding fathers like Washington and Jefferson themselves guided the design of iconic structures like the Capitol in the classical style, precisely to inspire civic virtue and convey stability.
Making that historical link.
Exactly. They contend that the subsequent shift to modernist and brutalist designs in the 1960s was deeply unpopular with the American public, and that this order simply reflects a return to popular, time-honored aesthetics.
What's particularly significant here is that this represents a direct federal intervention into cultural and aesthetic matters. While traditionalist organizations like the National Civic Heart Society have hailed it as a watershed moment, what's been the reaction from the professional architectural community?
Well, the American Institute of Architects, for one, expressed extreme concern.
Okay.
They argue that mandating a single style stifles innovation, hinders design freedom, and is contrary to America's diverse cultural landscape.
Diverse culture, diverse architecture is the argument.
Essentially, yes. And architectural historians, such as Reinhold Martin from Columbia University, have linked similar first-term orders to broader efforts to use culture and aesthetics to send coded messages about, well, about white supremacy and political hegemony.
Strong claims there.
They are. Practically, this will undoubtedly reshape architectural procurement processes across the federal government, elevating traditional styles and potentially sidelining contemporary architects and design firms.
Okay. Now, these sweeping executive actions were set against a backdrop of numerous pressing domestic and international issues, which became very clear in a contentious White House press briefing on August 28th.
Right. The briefing really highlighted the pressure cooker environment.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt's briefing touched on a wide spectrum of challenging policy fronts. Topics included U.S. foreign policy amid global tensions, ongoing trade disputes, national security, and efforts to roll back climate change policies.
A lot on the plate.
A lot. The briefing also confirmed discussions with Jared Kushner regarding a plan for post-war Gaza, and notably, the termination of the CDC director, Dr. Susan Monterez.
Which we'll get into more detail on soon.
Exactly. Leavitt also faced questions about allegations of Americans with ties to the president running covert influence operations in Greenland, which led Denmark, a key NATO ally, to summon the U.S. envoy for an explanation.
Yeah, that Greenland story raised eyebrows. And multiple media outlets characterized the briefing by its fiery and heated exchanges.
Fiery and heated.
One particularly sharp confrontation arose when Leavitt was questioned about reports that President Trump had actually paused a meeting with European officials to take a phone call from Russian President Vladimir Putin.
Wow.
It's noteworthy how the administration maintains this combative posture, often using press briefings as a stage for direct confrontation.
This briefing offers a critical window into the administration's concurrent priorities and its, well, combative posture toward the media. The sheer range of topics shows an administration engaged on many high-stakes fronts. What are the broader implications for media relations and public perception when we see such a contentious tone regularly?
Well, the contentious tone isn't just reactive. It often appears to be a deliberate strategic choice designed to delegitimize critical media coverage and reinforce a narrative of a besieged president for its base.
Play to the base.
It fosters an environment where the media is often cast as an adversary, impacting how information is filtered and perceived by the public.
Also on August 28, President Trump issued a proclamation for Labor Day 2025. This document is a key piece of political messaging.
Yes, the text honors the skill, determination, and unwavering resilience of the American worker, but it quickly pivots to a political critique.
Okay, here comes the pivot.
Blaming a corrupt political class for manufacturing decline and shipping jobs overseas. This rhetoric aligns perfectly with the administration's populist and protectionist economic agenda.
Right.
Seeking to justify actions like the executive order on collective bargaining and ongoing trade tariffs as necessary measures to protect American workers and national interests.
Connecting those dots. And we also saw official publication of several other proclamations and executive orders from previous days.
Just catching up on the paperwork.
Right, including one commemorating the fourth anniversary of the attack at Abbey Gate in Afghanistan and executive orders related to ending cashless bail in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
These broad executive actions paint a picture, but sometimes the real-world impact hits hardest with a specific example.
Absolutely.
And our sources highlight one particularly stark case illustrating these very trends. The unfolding crisis at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC.
Yes, this one is deeply concerning.
This wasn't just an internal personnel matter. It strikingly illustrates the prioritization of political alignment over scientific expertise with profound implications for national health security.
And this immediately brings up a critical point regarding the long-term integrity and effectiveness of our public health institutions, which are absolutely vital for national security and our ability to respond to future crises.
So the news. The White House confirmed on August 28 that CDC Director Dr. Susan Monterez had been terminated the previous day.
The day before.
Yes. This was less than a month after she had been confirmed by the Senate, making her the first CDC director to go through that process under a 2023 law.
A very short tenure after a new confirmation process.
Extremely short. A White House spokesman stated Monterez was dismissed because she was not aligned with the president's agenda and had refused a request to resign.
Not aligned.
Yeah.
That phrasing is key. This firing was clearly the culmination of escalating tensions between Dr. Monterez and Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
Right.
Who, as many know, is a prominent critic of established vaccine science.
A very public critic.
Yes. The primary contention revolved around Secretary Kennedy's moves to reshape vaccine policy, including his controversial decision to replace members of the Influential Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices with individuals openly critical of existing vaccine guidelines.
So, changing the advisory committee makeup.
Exactly. Dr. Morales, through her attorneys, stated she was targeted because she refused to rubber stamp unscientific, reckless directives and chose, as she put it, to protect public health over a political agenda.
A direct clash. What happened next was truly unprecedented. Dr. Monterez's termination triggered a mass resignation of the CDC's most senior scientific leadership. Can you walk us through who left and the tenor of their resignation letters?
It was stunning. Those who resigned in protest included Dr. Debah Howery, the agency's chief medical officer, Dr. Daniel Jernigan, head of emerging and zoonotic infectious diseases, Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis, a top vaccine official, and Dr. Jennifer Layden, who led the Office of Public Health Data.
Top-tier leadership.
Absolutely. The core scientific leadership. And their resignation letters were scathing. Dr. Daskalakis wrote that he was unable to serve in an environment that treats CDC as a tool to generate policies and materials that do not reflect scientific reality.
Wow.
Dr. Harry lamented the crippling effects on the agency from budget cuts and political interference, stating unequivocally that the science at CDC should never be censored or subject to political pauses or interpretations. This was not a quiet departure. It was a public and forceful statement.
A clear message. And what about the new leadership? Who has been brought in to fill this critical void at the CDC?
On August 28, Jim O'Neill was appointed as the acting director of the CDC.
Acting director.
Yes. O'Neill was serving as the deputy secretary of HHS under Secretary Kennedy. He's a former science and technology investor with notable ties to Peter Thiel. And importantly, he has no formal background in medicine or public health.
No public health background for the CDC director.
None formally listed. Though he has been a frequent critic of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, this appointment, following the mass resignations, really underscores the dramatic shift in priorities we're seeing.
Okay, so where does this leave us for national health security? The simultaneous departure of the agency's top five leaders creates an enormous, unprecedented leadership vacuum. How are public health experts reacting to this critical situation?
The reaction from the public health community has been, frankly, alarming. Dr. Georges Benjamin of the American Public Health Association described it as having disrupted the whole chain of command, akin to getting rid of your generals in the middle of a war.
Strong analogy.
Very. The American Medical Association warned it leaves the nation highly susceptible to public health threats. We're talking about very real immediate consequences, potential delays in responding to outbreaks like measles or foodborne illnesses, and widespread confusion over vaccine availability and public health guidance.
It feels like a profound politicization of a premier scientific institution. Beyond the immediate chaos, what are the long-term consequences of this kind of move on scientific integrity and public trust?
It is truly a profound and deliberate politicization. The explicit reason for Dr. Menares's firing, a lack of political alignment and her replacement by a political appointee with no public health credentials, sends an unmistakable message. Loyalty to the administration's agenda is now valued over scientific expertise.
Loyalty over expertise.
That's the message it sends. This threatens to fundamentally undermine the credibility of all CDC guidance, both domestically and globally. Long term, this turmoil will likely trigger a significant brain drain as seasoned scientists and public health professionals leave,
right,
severely hampering the nation's ability to prepare for and respond to future pandemics, bioterrorism, and other health emergencies. Public trust in the CDC, already strained after recent years, is likely to erode further, with potentially devastating consequences for future public health campaigns, especially around vaccinations.
Zooming out, the crisis at the CDC really is a microcosm of the administration's broader governance strategy, isn't it?
Absolutely. The demand for a responsive and accountable civil service, as we saw with the executive order on collective bargaining, manifested directly in the firing of a director not politically aligned.
There's that phrase again.
Exactly. It's a clear maneuver to deconstruct the agency's independent, science-based culture and replace it with one that directly serves the executive's political and ideological objectives rather than an independent scientific mandate.
Okay. From federal agencies in turmoil, let's pivot to another significant area of change: immigration and higher education, where a new paradigm is being proposed. Now, let's turn our attention to this next development.
Right.
In a move poised to reshape American higher education and our ability to attract global talent, the Department of Homeland Security, or DHS, initiated a major regulatory overhaul targeting international students, scholars, and journalists.
A huge area.
This represents a fundamental shift away from decades of established immigration policy.
And this immediately brings up a critical point regarding America's global competitiveness and our reputation as a destination for the world's brightest minds. What's particularly striking here is the ripple effect this could have across numerous sectors, from scientific research to economic growth.
So on August 28, DHS published a notice of proposed rulemaking in the Federal Register titled Establishing a Fixed Time Period of Admission and an Extension of Stay Procedure for Non-Immigrant Academic Students, Exchange Visitors, and Representatives of Foreign Information Media.
A mouthful, but important.
Very. The proposed rule seeks to eliminate the long-standing duration of status, or DS, policy for individuals on F, J, and I visas that's primarily for academic students, exchange visitors, and foreign media representatives.
So getting rid of DS.
Exactly. This policy, in place since 1978 for students, allowed them to remain in the U.S. as long as they maintained their full-time student status or program participation, offering a degree of flexibility.
Right. It adapted to program length.
This new rule would replace that flexible DS system with a rigid, fixed-term admission period. Can you walk us through the new maximums and the new bureaucratic hoops, especially for long-term students?
Sure. Under the proposed rule, F&J non-immigrants would be admitted for a maximum of 4 years.
4 years max, initially.
Right. This is a crucial change, because those in longer programs, like most PhD candidates, or even some undergraduate degrees that might require extra time, would now need to proactively apply for an extension of stay with USCIS.
Another application, more paperwork, more fees, presumably.
Exactly. This introduces a brand new, complex, and potentially costly bureaucratic process for hundreds of thousands of students. Furthermore, the rule also imposes new academic restrictions.
Oh, like what?
F1 graduate students would be prohibited from changing their educational objectives or programs at any point, and undergraduate F1 students would be barred from changing their major during their first year.
Wow, very restrictive on academic path.
Very. Plus, the post-completion grace period for F1 students, which allows them a short window after graduation, would be cut in half, from 60 days to just 30 days.
Less time to find work or make arrangements. Now, the administration has resurrected this proposal after a similar rule in 2020 was withdrawn by the Biden administration. What's the stated rationale for these significant changes?
Well, DHS argues the existing DS framework provides insufficient oversight and, they claim, incentivizes fraud. They cite what they call forever students who perpetually enroll in courses.
Forever students.
Right. And as evidence, our sources show DHS identified over 2,100 students who entered between 2000 and 2010 and still held active F visas as of April 2025.
Okay, 2,100 over a decade or more.
The administration frames these changes primarily as a national security measure to enhance monitoring of non-immigrant visa holders.
How has this proposed rule been received? What's the immediate reaction from key stakeholders like university associations and immigration attorneys?
It's been met with swift and widespread condemnation from across the academic and legal communities.
Strong words.
Very. Fanta Awe, CEO of NAFSA, Association of International Educators, called it a dangerous overreach that would force aspiring students into administrative delays. Miriam Feldblum, CEO of the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration, called it unnecessary and counterproductive, sending a message that talented individuals are not valued in the U.S.
Not the message you want to send for global talent.
Precisely. And immigration attorneys also warned of severe unintended consequences, particularly regarding what's known as unlawful presence.
We'll get to that. What are the practical burdens and economic implications of this rule, not just for students themselves, but for our economy and academic institutions?
The burdens are immense. This rule would impose huge new administrative burdens and costs, not only on international students, but also on their host institutions and on the already backlogged USCIS.
Adding to the backlog.
Likely, yes. Students in multi-year programs would face constant uncertainty about their ability to complete their degrees, and universities would be saddled with entirely new compliance responsibilities. From an economic standpoint, international students are a significant engine.
How significant?
Contributing over $50 billion to the U.S. economy and supporting hundreds of thousands of jobs in 2023 alone. By creating such a hostile and uncertain environment, this rule is highly likely to drive talent to competitor nations like Canada, the UK, and Australia.
So a competitive disadvantage.
A potentially serious one, yes.
Yeah.
Harming both university finances and America's long-term economic competitiveness and innovative capacity.
Okay, this next detail truly shifts the perspective, and it's potentially quite severe, the effect on unlawful presence. Can you explain how this rule dramatically changes how unlawful presence is accrued and what the real-world consequences are for students?
This is really critical. Under the current system, unlawful presence typically accrues only after a formal finding of a status violation by immigration authorities.
So there's a process.
Right. This proposed rule changes this dramatically. A student would begin accruing unlawful presence the day after their fixed admission period expires.
The day after? Even if they've applied for an extension?
Yes. Even if an extension application is pending or if it's due to a minor administrative error outside their control, they could be racking up time. And accruing over 180 days of unlawful presence automatically triggers a 3 or 10 year bar on reentry to the U.S.
3 or 10 years, that's career ending for many.
It absolutely is for many international students and scholars who hope to return for further study, research, or work. It's like changing the rules of a game mid-play, making it far simpler to be disqualified without realizing it for something as minor as a missed deadline on an application.
The administration cites combating visa fraud, but the numbers they present, 2,100 long-term holders versus 1.6 million total F visa holders in 2023, seem vastly disproportionate to justify such a sweeping policy change. Does this disparity suggest a broader strategic objective at play here?
The disparity is indeed striking, isn't it? It strongly suggests that the administration's true policy objective may be a significant reduction in international students overall, rather than merely targeting a small number of alleged forever students.
So reduce the numbers indirectly.
It appears designed that way. By engineering a system so fraught with bureaucratic risk, cost, and severe penalties that it actively discourages new applicants. It's a strategic use of administrative friction and what's known as chilling effects to curtail legal immigration flows without needing to pass new, potentially contentious legislation through Congress.
Okay. While the executive branch launched its broad offensive, our sources show that allied forces in the U.S. Congress initiated a parallel effort, using a powerful legislative tool to advance a similar agenda. Now, let's turn our attention to this next piece.
Right, shifting to the legislative branch now.
While the executive branch was busy with its offensive, our sources tell us its allies in the U.S., House of Representatives launched a parallel effort on August 28. They're leveraging a powerful legislative tool to dismantle key environmental regulations enacted by the previous administration.
The Congressional Review Act.
Exactly. This legislative action, focused on federal land management, shows clear synergy with the White House's broader deregulatory agenda.
And what's particularly striking here is the use of the Congressional Review Act, or CRA, which is a uniquely potent legislative weapon. It can have lasting impacts far beyond a simple repeal of a rule, essentially locking in policy changes.
Let's break that down. On August 28, three separate joint resolutions were introduced in the House, each seeking to disapprove a specific rule submitted by the Bureau of Land Management, BLM, under the provisions of the CRA. The CRA allows Congress to overturn federal agency rules with a simple majority vote in both chambers, but as you mentioned, it has additional teeth. The targeted rules were three major resource management plans, RMPs, governing millions of acres in the American West and Alaska.
Major land areas involved.
Huge areas. Can you detail the specific RMPs targeted by HJ Res 104, 105, and 106, outlining what each of them addresses?
Absolutely. First, HJ Res 104 targets the Miles City Field Office RMP in Montana. This plan, which was finalized in November 2024, specifically prohibited new federal coal leasing on over 1.7 million acres in Montana's Powder River Basin.
Big coal country.
Exactly. A region known for its extensive coal deposits. Second, HJ Res 105 targets the North Dakota Field Office RMP. This plan replaced an older 1988 plan, limiting new oil and gas leasing in low development areas and restricting new coal leasing near existing mines in the state.
Okay, limiting new leases there.
And finally, HJ Res 106 targets the Central Yukon RMP in Alaska. This plan governs a vast area of 13.3 million acres.
13 million acres.
And designates 3.6 million of those acres as areas of critical environmental concern or research natural areas. Its primary purpose was to protect vital wildlife habitats, important salmon-producing watersheds, and areas of significant cultural importance to indigenous tribes in Alaska.
So, major conservation components in that one. What's the stated rationale from proponents of these CRA resolutions, particularly from congressional delegations and industry groups?
Well, proponents, often led by congressional delegations from the affected states, frame the BLM's RMPs as job-killing environmentalist mandates from the previous administration.
Familiar rhetoric.
Yes. They argue these plans unnecessarily restrict access to vital natural resources, stifle economic growth, and ultimately threaten America's energy security. For example, Representative Ryan Zink of Montana specifically stated that overturning the Miles City plan was necessary to achieve true American energy dominance.
Energy.
That's the term used. This perspective is very strongly supported by powerful industry groups like the National Mining Association and the American Petroleum Institute, who advocate for greater access to federal lands for resource extraction.
And on the other side, what are conservation organizations saying about this legislative effort?
On the opposing side, conservation organizations like the Sierra Club, the National Wildlife Federation, and the Wilderness Society view these CRA resolutions as an unprecedented assault on science-based collaborative public land management.
An assault.
That's their framing. They argue that the targeted RMPs were the product of years of extensive scientific review and robust public input from local communities, indigenous tribes, and hunters, representing a carefully balanced approach required by federal law. They characterize the CRA effort as nothing short of a giveaway to corporate polluters that bypasses critical public process and profoundly undermines federal land stewardship, jeopardizing ecosystems and cultural heritage.
The takeaway from using the CRA is its unique and long-lasting power. How does it differ from standard legislation, and what kind of long-term regulatory impact can it have?
Yeah, the CRA is incredibly powerful because it's not just a simple repeal. A successful CRA resolution not only nullifies the targeted rule, but here's the critical part. It also prohibits the agency from reissuing a new rule that is substantially the same as the one disapproved, unless Congress specifically authorizes it.
Substantially the same. So it really ties the agency's hands.
It does. It can effectively create a long-term regulatory vacuum, making it incredibly difficult for future administrations to implement similar protections. It's designed to lock in a deregulatory policy, making it a much more permanent tool than simply passing a new law.
The selection of these specific RMPs feels highly strategic. Mm-hmm. What does overturning them mean for land use across these vast regions? And what larger political and economic fault lines does this expose?
The selection is indeed highly strategic. Together, they govern land use across tens of millions of acres in regions central to our nation's coal, oil, and natural gas reserves.
Key energy regions.
Absolutely. Overturning them wouldn't just reverse specific conservation measures. It would often revert management of these lands to outdated plans from the 1980s and 90s, or in some cases leave areas with no modern management plan at all.
Back to older, likely less protective standards.
Generally, yes. This would immediately reopen vast areas to potential fossil fuel development under far less stringent environmental considerations than modern plans would require. This also exposes deep and persistent political and economic fault lines over federal lands, pitting a legislative agenda focused on maximizing resource extraction against an approach that seeks to balance extraction with conservation and climate resilience.
It's noteworthy how these CRA resolutions were introduced on the same day as the president's major executive actions. What does this synchronization tell us about the broader strategy at play?
Yeah, that timing is almost certainly no coincidence. It's a demonstration of powerful synergy between the legislative and executive branches.
A coordinated effort.
Seems very much so. By launching these efforts simultaneously, they create a high velocity of change designed to overwhelm opposition and secure a broad deregulatory agenda on multiple fronts. It suggests a very deliberate and coordinated strategy to effect rapid, far-reaching transformation.
Okay. Now, let's turn our attention to the third branch of government, where our sources suggest the federal judiciary delivered rulings that stood in stark contrast to these trends emanating from the executive and legislative branches.
Great. The courts had a different story to tell on this day.
While the executive and legislative branches were engaged in this coordinated push, our sources indicate that the judicial branch delivered a series of rulings on August 28 that stood in, well, stark contrast to the prevailing political currents.
Mm-hmm.
These decisions, focused on fundamental issues of voting rights and the separation of church and state, positioned the federal courts as a primary arena for contesting the new administration's agenda and its manifestations at the state level.
And what's particularly striking here is that the U.S. Supreme Court was in its summer recess during this period.
Right. They weren't issuing rulings.
Exactly. No orders or opinions were issued on August 28 or 29. This puts the lower federal courts squarely in the spotlight as the day's main judicial actors, effectively acting as a crucial check on legislative and executive actions.
So, first up, the Ninth Circuit. On August 28, a panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit issued a significant decision in the case of Soto Palmer v. Hobbs, which was on appeal as Palmer v. Trevino.
A voting rights case.
Yes. The court affirmed a lower court victory for Latino voters in Washington State's Yakima Valley. The ruling rejected an appeal brought by three individual voters who had challenged a federal district court's finding that the state's 15th legislative district violated Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act.
Section 2.
By unlawfully cracking the Latino community, thereby diluting their voting power.
And the Ninth Circuit's decision? It was methodically grounded in both procedural and constitutional law.
Well,
the panel first found that the interveners, those individual voters appealing, lacked legal standing to appeal the district court's core, finding that the original map violated the VRA.
So a standing issue first.
Right. Second, the court affirmed that the new court-drawn remedial map did not constitute an unconstitutional racial gerrymander, concluding that race was not the predominant factor, but rather that traditional redistricting principles were properly considered.
Okay.
And, importantly, the state of Washington itself had accepted the district court's original ruling and chose not to appeal this.
The state didn't fight it further. What's the practical consequence of this ruling for voting rights advocates and the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act, especially in today's legal landscape where VRA challenges can be so difficult?
Well, this ruling represents a critical victory for voting rights advocates and a robust defense of the Voting Rights Act in a legal environment that has become, frankly, increasingly hostile to its enforcement.
A needed win for them.
Yes. It successfully preserves a fair electoral district for the Latino community, ensuring their voting power isn't diluted. Furthermore, the court's analysis on intervener standing is particularly consequential.
Why is that important?
Because it could potentially create a procedural barrier against future efforts to undermine VRA enforcement through protracted and often politically motivated legal challenges by third parties, not the state itself.
Interesting procedural point. Okay, moving to another case. In a case highlighting intense culture war battles at the state level, a federal judge in Arkansas issued a temporary restraining order, or TRO, on August 28.
The Ten Commandments case.
Exactly. This order required the Conway School District to remove displays of the Ten Commandments from all of its classrooms and libraries by 5 p.m. the following day.
And this TRO, it was an extension of an earlier legal battle concerning Arkansas's Act 573.
Right, there was a previous ruling.
Yes. On August 4th, U.S. District Court Judge Timothy Brooks had already issued a preliminary injunction blocking several other school districts from implementing the very same law. In that earlier ruling, Judge Brooks found that the state law, which mandates posting a specific Protestant version of the Ten Commandments in every public school classroom, is obviously unconstitutional and a clear violation of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
Obviously unconstitutional, strong language from the judge.
Very direct. The specific TRO against Conway was issued after the district proceeded to hang the displays, despite the judge's clear preliminary ruling, prompting families in that district to join the ongoing lawsuit.
So they went ahead anyway, and the judge slapped them with a TRO.
What are the contrasting viewpoints on Act 573? How do proponents like Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Attorney General Tim Griffin defend it versus civil liberties groups like the ACLU and Americans United for Separation of Church and State? Well, proponents of Act 573, including Governors Sarah Huckabee Sanders and Attorney General Tim Griffin, defend the law by arguing that the Ten Commandments are a foundational historical document for Western law and morality, not solely a religious text.
The historical document argument.
Right. They assert that displaying them is merely acknowledging this historical significance. Conversely, a coalition of civil liberties groups, including the ACLU and Americans United for Separation of Church and State, argue that the law is a blatant and unconstitutional government endorsement of a specific religion.
A violation of church and state separation.
Exactly. They contend it coerces captive public school children into religious observance and infringes on parental rights to guide their children's religious upbringing.
The state's decision to pass this law and Conway's to implement it despite a federal court ruling seems to indicate a deliberate strategy. What might be the strategic goal behind these actions, and how is the judiciary currently responding?
You're right. This indicates a deliberate strategy of legal provocation. Advocates for such laws have openly stated their goal: to create a test case that could ultimately reach the U.S. Supreme Court.
Ah, aiming for the Supreme Court.
Precisely. Hoping the current conservative majority will overturn decades of First Amendment precedent, particularly the 1980 ruling in Stone v. Graham, which prohibited similar displays. The federal court's swift TRO demonstrates the judiciary's current role as a crucial check on these state-level legislative efforts to challenge established constitutional principles.
So the court's acting as a check for now.
For now, yes. The overarching theme emerging here is that these judicial actions present a striking counter-narrative. While the executive and legislative branches pursued rapid policy transformation, the judiciary at this moment is acting as a bulwark, applying existing precedent to resist that transformation.
Interesting contrast.
It sets the stage for escalating conflicts over judicial appointments and the constitutional limits of executive and state authority.
As you can see, the events of these past 48 hours are far from isolated. Let's step back and look at the overarching strategic outlook these actions reveal. Now, let's unpack this final section.
Let's synthesize.
The confluence of federal government activities on August 28 and 29, 2025 wasn't a random assortment of policy announcements. Our sources clearly show it was a highly concentrated and strategically coherent demonstration of a transformative governing philosophy. Mm-hmm. When we view these actions as an interconnected whole, clear trajectories in U.S. governance emerge, and they illuminate the primary arenas of conflict for the foreseeable future.
And what's particularly striking here is the sheer velocity and scope of these changes. From this intensely busy 48-hour period, three dominant strategic thrusts clearly emerge, signaling significant shifts in how the federal government is being approached and managed.
Okay. Thrust number one.
Consolidation of executive authority.
Right. First, there's a clear and aggressive strategy to centralize power within the presidency and diminish the influence of any institution that might check that power.
We saw that clearly.
This was achieved through a multi-pronged assault on the independence of the federal civil service. The executive order revoking collective bargaining rights for over a million federal employees, for example, effectively neutralizes an organized source of internal resistance within the bureaucracy.
We also saw the presidential memorandum targeting federal grants for lobbying, which aims to silence external critics in the nonprofit and academic sectors.
Quieting outside voices.
Right. And the politically motivated purge of the CDC's scientific leadership and the installation of a loyalist acting director serves as a stark warning to all agency heads that ideological alignment is paramount.
Alignment above all else.
Together, these actions are designed to create a more compliant federal bureaucracy that responds directly to the White House's political will, reducing the autonomy and expertise of career civil servants.
Okay, trajectory number two.
Systematic deregulation and policy reversal.
Secondly, the administration is not merely adjusting prior policies. It's engaged in a systematic effort to dismantle the regulatory frameworks of its predecessor, particularly in the environmental and immigration spheres.
Yeah, the examples are stark. the introduction of Congressional Review Act resolutions to nullify three major Bureau of Land Management resource plans is a powerful example.
Using the CRA again?
Not just reversing existing regulations, but critically, preventing future administrations from issuing substantially similar rules without new legislation. Similarly, the proposed DHS rule to end duration of status for international students is a fundamental reversal of decades-old policy.
Decades old.
A policy that historically made the U.S. an attractive destination for global talent, but is now seemingly designed to be a deterrent.
And the third major theme.
Intensification of cultural and political polarization.
And finally, our sources show the administration is actively leveraging the power of the federal government to prosecute cultural and political battles.
Yes. The executive order mandating classical architecture for federal buildings is a direct intervention into the nation's aesthetic and cultural life, an attempt to codify a specific traditionalist vision of American identity.
Imposing an aesthetic.
And illegal battles over Ten Commandments displays in public schools further illustrate this trend. These are not peripheral issues. They are central to an agenda that seeks to impose a particular ideological and cultural vision on the nation's public and civic institutions, often through the courts or executive mandates.
Okay, so those are the three main trajectories. Now, the velocity and scope of the changes initiated on August 28th and 29th set the stage for significant conflict and instability across multiple domains. So what are the broader implications for the future? Where are the conflicts likely to erupt?
Well, this immediately brings up a critical point regarding interbranch conflict.
Executive versus judiciary.
Likely, yes. The aggressive use of executive authority, especially the expansive interpretation of national security to justify gutting civil service protections, will inevitably face robust legal challenges. This places the judiciary in the pivotal role of arbitrating the constitutional limits of presidential power.
And we saw the courts pushing back already.
Exactly. The judiciary's rulings on August 28 in the Washington voting rights case and the Arkansas religion case signal a current willingness to serve as a check, which sets the stage for a protracted struggle between the branches.
Beyond the immediate conflicts, what are the projected long-term impacts on institutional norms and expertise within the federal government?
Well, we project a significant erosion of institutional norms and expertise. The politicization of scientific agencies like the CDC and the broad disempowerment of the federal workforce threaten lasting damage.
Lasting damage.
Yes. The loss of expert leadership and a potential brain drain will degrade the government's ability to respond effectively to complex challenges, from future pandemics to economic crises. The long-term cost will be a decline in policy effectiveness, a diminished global reputation for American scientific leadership, and a reduction in public trust in governmental institutions.
Serious long-term costs.
Profound implications for how the country functions and its standing in the world.
And on the global stage, how might the administration's America First posture and recent foreign policy moves impact international relations?
Globally, the administration's America First posture, evident in its policies on trade, immigration, and diplomacy, is poised to increase friction. The proposed rule on student visas, for example, will likely be seen by other nations as a hostile act,
driving talent away,
potentially triggering retaliatory measures and driving crucial talent elsewhere. The controversy over alleged U.S. influence operations in Greenland has already strained relations with a key NATO ally, Denmark, highlighting a broader pattern of diplomatic challenges.
And the Middle East.
Most critically, the administration's emerging plan for post-war Gaza, which reportedly includes the permanent displacement of the Palestinian population, has been met with fury and unequivocal rejection from key regional partners like Egypt and Jordan.
Fury and rejection.
Yes. Pursuing such a plan, which many international observers view as contrary to international law, would likely destabilize the Middle East, shatter key alliances, and leave the United States diplomatically isolated on one of the world's most intractable issues.
A huge potential flashpoint. And finally, what about domestically? These 48 hours have clearly defined the key battlegrounds for the coming years. Where should we expect the main struggles to play out?
Domestically, the courts will certainly be central to numerous legal challenges to executive orders and legislative actions.
Lots of lawsuits.
Expect many. Congress will likely see further CRA actions, contentious budget battles, and oversight hearings as different factions try to push their agendas or resist changes. And federal agencies themselves will become sites of struggle.
Internal struggles.
Yes. As new political leadership tries to implement the agenda against a potentially resistant career workforce. The fundamental contests over the nature of the American administrative state, the future of environmental regulation, and the scope of civil and constitutional rights will undoubtedly dominate the national political landscape for the foreseeable future.
Wow, what a comprehensive deep dive we've just taken into the rapid-fire federal news of August 28th and 29th, 2025.
It was a whirlwind.
It really was. We've seen an incredibly concentrated and strategic effort across the executive, legislative, and judicial branches to fundamentally reshape American governance.
Indeed. Stepping back, we've explored the consolidation of executive authority, systematic deregulation, and an intensification of cultural and political polarization. Each action, when viewed in context, reveals a clear trajectory for future conflicts and profound implications across all sectors of society.
As you reflect on the sheer volume and interconnectedness of these actions, here's a thought for you to mull over. How might this sustained multi-front pressure fundamentally alter the long-term balance of power between the branches of government? And what does that mean for the resilience of our democratic institutions in the years to come?
A crucial question.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope it has given you a shortcut to being truly well-informed. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and keep learning.